6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Airstrikes kill mid-level Islamic State leaders. The U.S. military says an Islamic State leader with direct links to the alleged ringleader of last month's terrorist attacks in Paris was killed in a coalition airstrike in Syria. Coalition spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said at a news briefing Tuesday, Sharaf el-Muadan was killed Christmas Eve.
He was a Syrian-based ISIL member with a direct link to Abdel Hamid Aboud, the Paris attack cell leader. Al-Mudain was actively planning additional attacks against the West. So my point is this, we will continue to hunt ISIL leaders who are working to recruit, plan, and inspire attacks against the United States of America and our allies.
Warren noted that Mouadine was among a total of 10 IS leadership figures killed in coalition airstrikes in the past month. They include another IS figure who had links to the Paris terror network and a Bangladeshi man educated in Britain, allegedly a hacker for Islamic State. Burkina Faso has a new leader for the first time in nearly 30 years, President Roch Marc Kabore, taking the oath of office Tuesday.
Je jure devant le peuple burkinabé.
Mr. Kabore promised to preserve, respect, enforce, and defend the Constitution at a ceremony from Ouagadougou broadcast live on Burkinabé Radio and Television. Mr. Kabore's swearing-in comes 14 months after former President Blaise Compaoré was overthrown in a mass uprising sparked by an attempt to extend his 27-year rule. A transitional government organized the presidential ballot that Mr. Kabore won last month with 53% of the vote. The vote originally set for October, but delayed by a failed coup attempt by members of Burkina Faso's elite presidential guard. This is VOA News. The Obama administration has expressed growing concern over an increase in civilian casualties in Syria since Russia began airstrikes. U.S. spokesman Mark Toner said Secretary of State John Kerry brought the matter up in a phone call with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
NGOs have reported the Russian airstrikes in Syria have killed hundreds of civilians, including first responders, hit medical facilities, schools and markets, and led to the displacement of over 130,000 Syrians in October and the first half of November. Of course, we're deeply, deeply concerned about these reports of high civilian casualties. In particular, we've seen a marked and troubling increase in reports of these civilian casualties since Russia commenced its air campaign there.
Russia has denied causing civilian deaths in Syria. It says its airstrikes against what it called terrorists are carefully coordinated with the Syrian army to avoid civilian targets. North Korean state media say a top aide to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has died in a car crash. 73-year-old Kim Yong-gon, head of the Pyongyang United Front Department, the unit that manages the North's ties with South Korea, died early Tuesday. Greg Scarlato is head of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea.
Of course, there is always suspicion of foul play. Even downtown Pyongyang, one cannot see that many cars. We're not sure as to the actual location of the accident. But whenever one hears a story about a senior official having been killed in a car crash, suspicion of foul play is always there.
A career party diplomat, Kim led a high-level delegation that held emergency talks in August with South Korean envoys after troops from the rival government's traitor artillery fire, part of a dispute over South Korean propaganda broadcasts into the North. A suicide blast in Mardan, Pakistan, left at least 26 dead, more than 20 wounded. The blast in the city northwest of Islamabad occurred outside the door of a government office responsible for issuing identity cards. Jamaat al-Ahrar, which is part of the anti-state alliance of Islamist groups called Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, has claimed responsibility. Voters in Central African Republic are heading to the polls Wednesday in national elections aimed at ending more than 2 years of sectarian violence that has killed thousands and displaced millions. It follows a coup by the Muslim Salika alliance that ousted the government of President Francois Bozizé. Violence and organizational difficulties have repeatedly delayed the vote. 30 candidates are vying for president. Nearly 2 million voters will cast ballots for a legislature. Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan Tuesday signed an agreement with two French companies to carry out studies on the potential impact of Ethiopia's Grand Renaissance Dam on the flow of the Nile River. It's part of a months-long effort to forge a joint approach to handling water supplies. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, December 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The people of the Central African Republic are voting today in presidential and parliamentary elections.
I don't believe that this election will be free and fair. And from the beginning, we have been talking to the international community and the people in the country over there running the country to postpone that election because, as you have said, there is armed group all around the place.
Eugene Pewa Pelema is an analyst and president of the Central African Community Council. South Sudan President Salva Kiir has sworn in governance of the 28 new states he recently created. A new report highlights the struggles of African journalists, and Guinea has been declared Ebola-free.
We will maintain a presence in every prefecture of Guinea, every district of Sierra Leone, and every county of Liberia for the next 12 months. We will have to support local healthcare workers in the prevention, detection, and response to potential outbreaks.
Richard Brenner is Director of Ebola Response and Coordination at the World Health Organization. After beating inflation, Zimbabweans now face a new economic problem and a focus on the U.S. International Visitors Program. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The people of the Central African Republic are voting today in presidential and parliamentary elections that they hope would end years of conflict between mostly Christians and Muslims. There are altogether 30 presidential candidates. Joining us now from Washington is Eugene Pewa Pelema, analyst and president of the Central African Community. Good morning, Eugene.
Good morning.
And welcome to Daybreak Africa. I think the first place to start is, can today's election be free and fair, given the fact that there are too many arms groups in the country?
I don't believe that this election will be free and fair. And from the beginning, we have been talking to the international community and the people in the country over there running the country to postpone that election because, as you have said, there is armed group all around the place. Even the organization of the election is not well done. You can see they were supposed to vote on Sunday. Last Sunday, they postponed by 3 days. And I think until now, they still have some problem, logistic problem on ground.
So let's take a look at the candidates. Who do you think are the leading individuals among the so-called, I think there's about, 30 candidates?
That's correct. This time there is 30 candidates, but I can think that in the first group of candidates, those we have chance to be able to be elected. You have Anissé Georges Dologele, Martin Zigele, Désiré Kolingba, or Karim Mekaswa. So those are the names that come often, even if more and more Martin Zigele is not seen as very popular, but the Central African people who think that he has been very involved with some group that they don't like in the country.
You mentioned Dologele. He's a former prime minister. He has described himself as a man of peace. And do you think he stands a chance?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think he's a man of peace. He has been, as you have said, the prime minister. But I think what makes a difference with him is the fact that he just signed an agreement with the party of former president François Bozizé. And as you know, in Central African Republic, most of the time the people vote by region. So the group that follow François Bozizé is a big group, is a very important part of the population. And if they follow what President Bozizé has asked them to do, that means voting for Anissé Dologele, he becomes the favorite candidate during this election that will be done this morning.
Eugene, I'm assuming that a country that has been at war with itself since 2012, that peace and security should be the top priorities as the people go into the polls.
That's correct. I mean, since the transition, the people have failed to bring back the security. The international community has failed to help the transitional government, to make it happen. As you know, when President Bozizé has been removed from power, the army from François Bozizé has disappeared. So Seleka took over, and then the international community, the French army, came, and they were the one running the security of the country. But since they have been there, they have done nothing to disarm the armed group. they have put an embargo on the CAR army, so the CAR army cannot work and do security. So they depend on the international community forces. And now the international community have forced an election in a situation that, I mean, is not supposed to happen. But we will go to the election, and I believe that it will be a big struggle because the new president will depend again on this international community forces. So the election is not, I can say, the solution to solve the problem in CAR.
Eugene, thank you very much again for speaking with us. And let me say Happy New Year to you and your family.
Thank you for having me, and Happy New Year to you and all the people listening to your program.
Eugene Pewa-Pelleman is an analyst and president of the Central African Community. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization has declared Guinea free of Ebola transmission. The WHO says this marks an important milestone in the two-year struggle to stop the spread of the deadly disease, which has claimed the lives of thousands of people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Guinea has passed 42 days without a confirmed case of Ebola, making it the third of three severely affected countries after Liberia and Sierra Leone to have stopped the spread of this deadly disease. This is also the first time all three countries have halted the original chains of transmission of Ebola since the virus was first detected in Gekedu, Guinea in December 2013. Director of Ebola Response and Coordination at the World Health Organization, Richard Brennan, calls this a significant achievement, but he warns the disease could reemerge. He tells VOA, Guinea and other countries in West Africa must not become complacent. They must remain vigilant.
Between March and November this year, we've had 10 mini outbreaks of Ebola, what we're calling flares of Ebola. And they have occurred due to reemergence of the virus in individuals because of persistence of the virus in survivors.
Dr. Brennan explains the virus may remain in the semen of some survivors for as long as 9 to 12 months, during which time Ebola could be sexually transmitted. Therefore, he says, Guinea now enters a 90-day period of heightened surveillance to make sure new cases are quickly identified before they can spread to other people. He says WHO will actively monitor the situation in Guinea as well as in the other West African countries.
We will maintain a presence in every prefecture of Guinea, every district of Sierra Leone, and every county of Liberia for the next 12 months. We will have to support local healthcare workers in the prevention, detection, and response to potential outbreaks.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa was the worst in history. It was unprecedented in scale and complexity. Since the onset of the disease in March 2014, 11,300 people have died in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and more than 28,600 have been infected with the virus. The World Health Organization does not rule out future outbreaks of Ebola in the West African region. It acknowledges many mistakes have been made, but many lessons have been learned in the course of dealing with this epidemic. Consequently, it says Ebola medical response teams now are better placed to detect and respond quickly to future outbreaks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir says his Christmas Eve decree appointing 28 governors for his newly created 28 states will not hamper the implementation of the August peace agreement. Instead, Mr. Kiir says the move will bring development and good governance to his country. As Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Juba, President Kiir made the comments Tuesday when he administered the oath of office to the 28 new governors.
The 28 governors were sworn in at a ceremony in Juba. President Kiir first thanked the outgoing governors for what he called their hard work during the time South Sudan was established as a new nation, then turned his attention to the newly appointed governors.
Now that you are going to take charge of the newly created states that are not in existence, so when you go there, it needs your real work so that you build a state that people will be proud of.
Only seven governors have been retained from the previous 10 states. President Kiir downplayed the significance of the opposition voiced by many South Sudanese politicians and outside observers the newly created states, saying the August peace agreement does not prevent the nation from working on programs that bring development.
We cannot just be told to sit with our folded arms, not to move forward. The country needs to be moved forward. And this is why we have been struggling to create these institutions of governance so that we move our country forward.
President Kiir says the primary responsibility of the governors will be to help implement the signed peace deal, but he admits that won't be easy.
I understand there are people who are still breathing fire of the damages that happened to their states, and that they have not accepted this idea of reconciliation. No, you must stand firm to convince them that war is over.
President Kiir instructed the governors to emulate the national government when the opposition visit their states and exercise restraint.
That they are in Juba, it is our responsibility as the national government to make sure that nobody touches them. The same thing when they go to your state, you, the governor, must make sure that these people are respected.
Governor Joseph Munyantil of the newly created state of Northern Leech, which was carved from Uyinte State, spoke on behalf of other new governors when he said they're up to the task that lies before them.
I would like to assure you our commitment as governors to that agreement and its implementation to letter and spirit. Comrade President, we will be always standing behind you very firm.
An SPLM-IO advance team of 150 people has been in Juba since the start of last week. Mr. Kiir did not say whether he would appoint some SPLM-IO members to high-ranking positions such as governors once they have been integrated into the new government. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, December 30th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The Committee to Protect Journalists has released its annual report on the killing of reporters around the world. From Nairobi, Lenny Ruvaga looks at what the report says about the state of media freedom in Africa.
46-year-old Waweru Mugo has been a journalist in Kenya for the last 15 years and now runs his own media consulting firm. It is not always easy. Last October, Kenyan lawmakers considered a bill that would ban the press from reporting on parliamentary matters. The controversial clauses were eventually removed amid protest from civil society and media organizations. According to Mugo, journalists in Kenya and all of Africa face challenges, especially attempts by governments to intimidate and censor them. This, he says, has limited the growth of a free press.
When you try to highlight some of these issues, the government tries to crack the whip. The government demands that you do ABCD, that you're not supposed to be unpatriotic. They label you as an unpatriotic. They say that you've been bought off by foreign interests, you're working for the opposition. So the journalists also kind of bend the whims of the government through self-censorship.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says 69 journalists around the world were killed while on duty this year. Many died at the hands of Islamist militant groups like Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. The biggest number came from Syria, but 11 were killed in Africa, including 5 in war-torn South Sudan. Dr. Felix Odimasi of the School of Law and Diplomacy at the University of Nairobi says the lack of government support makes journalists cautious about reporting from conflict areas like South Sudan, Somalia, and northern Nigeria.
Because one, they would not go out there to report, and two, those who dare to go out and report still know that they are at risk, and so they have to be very careful about what they report about and where they go.
Members of Africa's Fourth Estate have come under fire across the continent from multiple regimes. Amnesty International says the South African government and ruling African National Congress Party are pushing for a tribunal to regulate the media under the guise of transformation. Amnesty notes that in Ethiopia, many journalists and media workers are currently in prison or have been convicted in absentia because of their work. Besides South Sudan, other countries where journalists were killed in 2015 included Somalia, Kenya, Libya, and Ghana. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's economy ends 2015 with predictions that prices will continue falling in the new year. But as Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare, economists say that trend may not benefit anyone.
Most Zimbabweans seem to be worse off today than in 2009, when the Southern African nation abandoned its worthless currency and started using multiple currencies, chief being the US dollar. After years of staggering inflation, prices stabilize and things have changed course. There is now deflation in Zimbabwe. But John Robertson, an independent economist in Harare, explains that is not the good news it sounds like to either Zimbabweans and President Robert Mugabe's government.
Deflation is normally associated with people having money to spend but choosing not to buy the things they want because they will be cheaper next month or cheaper in 2 or 3 months' time. What's been shrinking in Zimbabwe is the buying power. Government's incomes are only payable out of tax revenues, and the tax revenues are going down.
Robertson says given the revenue and economic situation, the government should be shrinking its activities. Since it has not, he says that explains why President Mugabe's government cannot pay salaries for its workers in December. Gift Mungano is a senior economics lecturer at the University of Zimbabwe and a government consultant. He sums up Zimbabwe's journey from hyperinflation to deflation, both economic situations that have caused pain to most Zimbabweans. Part of the problem is the weak South African rand and Zambian kwacha, which has cut prices for the large amount of goods Zimbabwe buys from those two countries.
That's a major force causing deflation. But there's also another one which is going to remain with us permanently for medium to long-term future. Constrained demand, reduced demand has become a cancer in the bone marrow in Zimbabwe.
So in Zimbabwe, there were no goods to buy in 2009. Now there's no money to buy the available goods at the close of 2015. Both Mugano and Robertson said there's need to create investments to create a broader revenue base and employment in Zimbabwe to address the issue of deflation. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
For the past 75 years, emerging foreign leaders and professionals have been visiting the United States, getting first-hand knowledge of its culture, politics, and lifestyle, thanks to the International Visitor Leadership Program. It's a professional exchange program run by the U.S. State Department with the goal of cultivating lasting relationships. VOA's Helena Georgievich has more.
I would say, without exaggerating, that it changed my life.
Argentine business consultant Ricardo Vanella took part in the International Visitors Program in 2010. He's one of more than 200,000 potential foreign leaders who have visited the United States since President Franklin Roosevelt established the program in 1940. More than 300 of them would later become heads of state or heads of government, including Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, Nicolas Sarkozy, and Felipe Calderon. Others have become leaders in non-governmental organizations and the private sector. Jennifer Clinton heads a nonprofit group that runs the program for the State Department. She says it used to last for 3 months.
Now, over time, it's sort of consolidated into a three-week program. But the impact and the impressions that the participants take away from the experience still are very, very profound and make a big difference in terms of how they see the U.S., its people, its culture.
French businessman Pascal Dupeyra took part in the program in 2000, focusing on the internet and the economy. He saw a country different from the one he had imagined based on movies and TV.
The energy that I felt in this country, that really changed my life, because after that, I decided to run my own business. So, you see, it has been a tremendous change in my own and personal life.
Participants spend a week in Washington and 2 weeks in several other cities. Ricardo Vanella says it widened his perspectives.
We met a lot of people from many fields. I would say that professionally has also an impact. Not only your mind, but your network get broader and broader and broader.
As the program celebrates its 75th anniversary, Jennifer Clinton says its future funding by Congress could face difficulties.
One of the dynamics that's happening in the U.S. is a little bit of a sort of a closure of minds in terms of how we're engaging internationally, a little bit of fear of international engagement.
But she says with growing anti-American sentiment in many places, it's important to give people from around the world first-hand experience with Americans and American life. Helena Georgievich, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Newly elected Zimbabwe Football Association ZIFA president Philip Chiyangwa urges the Zimbabwe national team, the Warriors, to aim at reaching the finals at the African Nations Championship CHAN due to kick off in Rwanda next month. Chiyangwa spent Tuesday with the Warriors, who are in residential training in the capital, Harare. He assured the Warriors that ZIFA is doing everything possible to ensure that they have a smooth preparation for the CHAN event. In turn, Chiyangwa urges the Warriors to improve on their 2014 performance in Cape Town, South Africa, where they placed fourth. That is Zimbabwe's best performance at any Confederation of African Football competition since the country's independence in 1980. Zimbabwe and the Democratic Republic of Congo are said to be the only teams that will have participated in all CHAN tournaments since the inception of the biannual contest. Meanwhile, Portuguese tactician Paul Duarte returns for a second stint as coach of the Burkina Faso national team, the Stallions. The Burkina Faso Football Association revealed in the Burkinabe capital Ouagadougou on Tuesday. Duarte, who takes over from departed German Gernot Rohr, was in charge of the Stallions between 2008 and 2012. His first order of business is to find a winning combination against Uganda in their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in March next year. Turning to athletics, the city of Bydgoszcz in Poland is the only candidate bidding to stage the 2016 World Junior Athletics Championship, the IAAF revealed in Monaco, while Guayaquil in Ecuador, Italian capital Rome, Monterrey in Mexico, and Ukraine's capital Kiev are vying to stage the 2016 World Race Walking Team Championship. An accelerated bidding process was launched after Russia, who were initially set to stage the two events, was suspended from World Athletics. The IAAF confirms the hosts of these two events in a fortnight. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burkina Faso has a new leader for the first time in nearly 30 years as President Roch Marc Kabore took the oath of office on Tuesday. Kabore promised to preserve, respect, enforce, and defend the constitution in a ceremony from Ouagadougou broadcast live on Burkinami radio and television. Kabore's swearing-in comes 14 months after former President Blaise Compaoré was overthrown in a mass uprising. And global health authorities have declared Guinea free of Ebola after more than 2,500 people died from the disease in that country. The designation leaves only Liberia still waiting for an official end to the epidemic. And that's it for this Wednesday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beffer or Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryer, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the Sunny Side of Sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.